This episode is sponsored by the conference Inbound. Inbound 2021 online takes place October 12th through 14th and is hosted with love by HubSpot. No matter where you're tuning in from, you can connect with the global Black Inbound community across marketing, sales, customer success, and tech. Some of the speakers include Oprah Winfrey, Tristan Walker, CEO of Walker & Co. Brand, Gogi Gupta, founder and CEO of Gupta Media, and Uwe Myers Ferguson, PhD, Assistant Dean of Impact and Engagement and Associate Professor at Howard University, and more. You can register for free with a starter pass now and upgrade later, or upgrade now and kick back later. Learn more at inbound.com/register. Use code POCKIT, which is POCIT, for 15% off any paid pass. Ask your boss to expense it.
Yo, everyone, welcome back to Brand New Techish in the building. Oh, the team is back together. It's Michael Behane, and I am with
Abdesi.
Abdesi in the house. All right, cool. So, first story that it wasn't on our show notes, but basically it just popped up just before I was preparing for it. And basically Twitter is toying with the idea of a dislike button.
I'm going to be using that on all of your tweets. So if
your mental health isn't already been stretched and, you know, pressured enough, like be prepared to have your tweets downvoted. Now, apparently, though, it's not going to be visible to the public and you can't see it either. So it's actually kind of pointless. It's probably more for Twitter to internally assess what replies and what tweets are good and what accounts are high quality, basically. So if you tweet Abadesi, for example, you won't see whether you've been downvoted, and I can't see whether your tweet has been particularly downvoted. So right now, it's a bit pointless. I don't really see the point of it. But I think it's heading in a direction where eventually accounts will be flagged up if they have consistent downvotes. Now, whether that's a good thing, I don't know, because Twitter has a collection of different, there's different Twitters, you know, there's Black Twitter, I found myself one time in like racist English people Twitter, where like, you know, the EDL UKIP Twitter one time, and they were going in, and where Meghan Markle is the worst person ever, where, you know, Raheem Sterling is the worst person ever. And I feel like if enough people coalesce around a certain agenda, you can just start downvoting people, even if that person is completely within the right, if that makes any sense. Like, truth doesn't lie within the majority always, like, right? So whether this is a good thing, I don't know. I think it might lead to more like collectivized out and out war, where people are just like, all right, let's all like run up and downvote this person, and then the other groups are gonna be like, let's do that to you, and vice versa. Like, what say you? Like, do you think this is a good idea? Like, pointless? What do you think? And actually, do you think Twitter should be prioritizing other features as well?
Twitter. I was reading their announcement about it, and I could see that one of the reasons they're pushing this is to make sure that, you know, Twitter Threads, which is probably like one of their biggest kind of features at the moment, or at least one of the most popular formats that people are using to like disseminate information. So a Twitter thread is like a continued series of tweets. So for people like me with short attention spans, it's sometimes easier to read a Twitter thread than actually read an article. Yeah. And what they're trying to do is make sure that when people reply to Twitter threads, the most relevant replies are the ones that are surfaced. And I actually see this move as kind of similar to Instagram launching their pinned comment feature, right? So now on an Instagram post, you as the poster can pick which are like, you know, your top two or three comments that you'd like to get pinned to the top. So my reaction to this is like, Twitter's always playing catch up. I mean, I love Twitter, don't get me wrong, but you're just a bit too slow to innovate. And, you know, there's definitely a huge issue on Twitter in terms of like relevancy of tweets and relevancies of replies and just like relevancies of tweets that are connected to things like Twitter threads and stuff like that. So I think it's great that they're looking at ways to basically like potentially automate the replies in a thread that would never get any airtime whatsoever because they're just so obviously spammy or whatever. But it just feels a bit like that classic laggard behavior from their engineering team. Sorry, guys, I'm sure you're working hard, but come on.
their product development cycle was kind of pathetic, to be honest. The thing about the Instagram comments, actually, apparently, was I think it was Kim Kardashian that really helped them. So I think the Kardashians would post and they'd want all the other Kardashians to kind of signal boost the post. So like, all of us need to comment. But because the comments are all in just any order, you couldn't see that Kylie had responded, basically. So I think she spoke to Systrom and said, like, can we fix this? So that's why now whenever you see a post, it's always the verified people who are at the top of the post, basically the quote-unquote high-quality accounts, right? So
that's
just the interesting tidbit. I think I got that from that No Filter book, the Instagram book.
There's something kind of scary about being able to explicitly show a dislike for something online.
Yeah.
Because I feel like there's already so much hate and negativity on social media without any of those features existing. Like, people are creative enough in their evil to make people feel bad. So when we now create features like this, a part of me is just like I don't want to see a tweet about social justice that a bunch of trolls like dislike. Because I feel like the YouTube thumbs up and thumbs down is a bit indicative of that. Like, I spend a lot of time watching like maybe TED Talks about, you know, anti-racism or any academics speaking on things that are interesting to me, intersectional feminism or whatever. And I see the way people with an agenda use the thumbs down button on YouTube to make a point. And I just fear that there's a risk this could go that way.
Yeah, basically. So our boy Jeff, he survived, he made it. He joins the club with Branson as another tech billionaire astronaut. Yeah, he made it, man. You know, on the day of the launch, me and Abba were talking about it, or texting at least, and I said, there's about a 1 in 100 chance that he blows up here. So I'm glad he didn't blow up and he made it. It's actually a plot line in the show Billions, where like a famous billionaire in the show blows up because he's so gassed about going to space. Anyways, shout out to Jeff, he made it. You know what though? Obviously, we've always talked about this is kind of pointless. You know, I know you're quite passionate about how pointless this is. But what I found interesting was just the pettiness. Like, so Jeff Bezos' company, Blue Origin, released a tweet explaining why Branson technically didn't go to space. So it's called a Kármán line. And apparently you have to go above 100 kilometers to be recognized as an astronaut, basically. And they're like, you know what? Only 4% of the world recognizes Branson's distance or height as technically being in space, right? And it's like, why do this? Like, why not just be magnanimous and be like, shout out to Branson? Because you know when Branson did it, you know Elon Musk went, even though he's got a rival company, even though he's doing his own thing, he turned up and was like, listen man, you're doing your thing, good for you, right? Be magnanimous. Yeah. It makes you look so petty. Second mistake that he made was that he came off, and when he landed, he said, I want to thank Amazon employees and the Amazon customers because you all paid for this. And I think he thought that sounded nice. I think he thought, yeah, this is me being like, you know.
I want my money back.
Yeah, everyone was like, fam, are you mad? Anyways, I digress. Obviously on the...
Do you know what I was paying attention to? So I was watching the street, I think I was watching like the Bloomberg stream, and there was like, before launch, they were showing the control room, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And I was just looking for people of color up in there. I was just like, white man. And then there was like a black guy in there.
Come on.
I was like, just suddenly in the background. Was like, oh, what's up, brother? And I was just like, he needs to be at the front. And I was also just like, come on, Blue Origin. Like, come on. Like, you couldn't find any engineers from underrepresented backgrounds. Didn't see nobody in a wheelchair up in there. Didn't see any other black people, brown people, other colors of people. I was just like, oh, what a disappointment.
But what's amazing, actually, is that I know the Indian Space Agency is doing kind of bits, and I know the Nigerian Space Agency is doing its thing as well. Apparently, we got an email from a Nigerian individual who's quite cross at you, Abadesi, and your analysis of space. He thinks that you've taken it too far in terms of the hateration, but he said, oh, it's the Nigerian Space Agency. So, like, you know, shout out to them.
Okay, don't even get me started on the other things the Nigerian government should be spending their money on. As someone that's recently come back from Lagos, like, shall we just sort out a constant electricity supply and roads, please? But that's fine. Let me put my hateration on curb today.
Listen, do you, and I don't let nobody stop you being you. The thing that was funny, actually, there was a rich kid that was in there as well. So there was some 18-year-old who went up in there. And then I think there was a woman who...
Well, the story goes that there was one seat up for a bid.
Right.
Up for auction. And so someone bought that seat for, I don't know, how many millions of dollars.
And that was the person's father or mother, basically.
Well, due to a scheduling clash, the winner of the auction could not take up their seat. And so that seat went to the teenager. Now, I don't know what scheduling clash prevents you from becoming an astronaut, but it better have been good.
They got scared. That's what happened. I guarantee you. Someone was like, bro, are you sure about this? Yeah. And they were like, you know what? Yeah, I back out. I think someone showed them like a footage of like rockets just blowing up. I will say though that even though Branson didn't go as high, his ship looked better. I'll keep it real. His ship actually looked like a spaceship, and Jeff Bezos looked like a phallic object going in upwards.
His looked like the one at the end of Austin Powers. You know, like that really long montage at the end of Austin Powers with Dr. Evil, and he's like, look, it's a pecker, like blah, 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 like that whole bit. That's what his looked like. I actually wonder if there are some Austin Powers fans amongst the Blue Origin team.
Maybe.
It looks so similar.
Maybe. You know what? We'll leave the space story from there because we've broken it down a couple of times. But yeah, I'm glad that Jeff survived. the other thing, one quick tangential thing. So apparently now Clubhouse is open to the public. Like, you no longer need any invites. Oh. Anyone can just join now and think. What I decided to do was to look at the announcement on the Shade Room. So why did I do that? Because I love to throw shade. No, I'm joking. I'm a hater. No, what do you call it? Me and you probably, speaking to the choir, we obviously know how much black culture moves these platforms and how much black culture is influential to these platforms. So I take this as I was looking at the comments as a leading indicator to what is the consensus now on this platform, basically, right? Mm. If I was an investor, this is exactly what I would be doing. So I looked at the comments and everyone was like, too late, no one gives a damn, it's over, we've moved on, like, it's wrap, like, no one's on there, no one cares, like, the pandemic is over, like, not the pandemic is over, but it had its moment done, like, everyone's already on there, basically, like, so to me, as somebody who's convinced by that thesis that black culture moves American culture and American culture moves the world, with these social products, if I see that from people who are on the Shade Room comments, who are probably predominantly black, who are probably the most engaged on social media, saying that, it just backs up what I thought. And I think, let's just admit, I won the bet, Abba. Clubhouse is done. It's over. I won the bet. It's done. All right, cool. That is...
I feel like your confirmation bias is playing out pretty
completely
hard right now.
I'm looking for more things to back me.
You are seeking out evidence to back up your opinion. Like, if you remember, my thesis was not that Clubhouse would just take on social media in general. My thesis was that Clubhouse would reinvent live events that made sense to be audio first and audio only. And, like, I still think that opportunity is out there. I remain bullish.
Still bullish. So today you would invest if they said, you know, there's a round open... there we go.
I wouldn't. What would hold me back? No, because part of my investment thesis is to invest in women of color founders, right. And they're just two guys. So for that that's my criteria.
That's a cop out, though. I'm saying business sake. Let's say it was two women of color founders. Yeah. Okay. Pretend universe.
They're overvalued. They're overvalued.
Okay. All right. Cool. Fair enough.
They're overvalued.
Okay. Hold on.
But yo, if someone was just like, come along to my open mic, blah, 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 I'd be like, that's a jam. I'd be there. But I think, it has to make sense.
I think Spotify's eating their lunch, though. I think Spotify's eating their lunch because they've launched the Greenhouse or the Green Room, I think. And that's basically a Clubhouse version for musicians. So we'll see. I think too much competition, too much erosion of features from other platforms.
The world's opening up.
It was a moment in time, and I think they've done amazing. And I think the founders have cashed out and got their, you know, they've sold secondary shares, so they'll be great, like, good for them, kind of thing. But as a platform and as a product, I don't see it going far. I think ASICS Andreessen Horowitz is going to be left holding the bag on that investment. It's going to be a loss.
So as the world begins to open up again, well, in some more privileged parts of the world, let's be honest, there's increasing conversation about the return to the office, and in particular, Black women and their reluctance to return to the office. So I first read this story in the New York Times a few weeks ago. The journalist managed to interview a number of Black women who actually said they just feel a lot safer working from home because they're less subject to microaggressions about what they're wearing, their hair, this, that, and the other. And just all that other, you know, quotation marks, office banter that you tend to pick up that just occupies your headspace and distracts you from your job and makes you less productive. Now, this story has been doing the rounds again on social media. It's been making moves around Black Twitter. Business Insider talked about it as well. So Slack actually conducted a survey, Futureform survey, and they found that more Black employees prefer working from home compared to their white colleagues. And a lot of people, so I think 1 in 5 respondents said that they felt better about their sense of belonging while working remotely. So that was 1 in 5 Slack employees. Now, one of the recurring themes that comes up in terms of underrepresented employees' experience of toxic work culture is this idea of, like, a lot of the racism and discrimination and prejudice we feel happens in such a minor way, but multiple times over the course of a day, over a week, over a month, that it becomes death by 1,000 cuts. And I think that captures the essence of what a microaggression is so well, because so many people, especially people from dominant groups, they don't really get what microaggressions are. And, you know, for us, we always think that the prejudice we face is, like, super overt, like, oh, someone called me the N-word. And, like, that's just not the case. You know, all of the experiences I always had working in offices were people just doing seemingly innocuous, innocent things, like the jokes that they made or the comments that they made or the whatever. But it was those things that really made work just so unbearable and so horrible to be around. So I personally was not too surprised by this, but I was just wondering, you know, your experiences, Michael, of the working world. Were you shocked to hear this, that Black employees just feel safer at home and don't want to go back?
No, not at all. I mean, even listening to you, like, I think a few episodes ago, we were talking about remote work, and you just said, I just don't see the benefit of going back in at all in it. And I was more like hybrid, but I think that's more my bias in the sense that I have a majority Black team, basically. And I asked everybody, like, what do you prefer? And some people were like, a lot of us, with the majority, were like, you know, we don't mind a hybrid, like, once a week just to catch up every now and then. Luckily, we're all kind of in a similar city. We're in the same city. So, but in terms of my experience in the quote-unquote mainstream corporate world, I haven't had as much experience as you, but the little that I did have, I found it kind of exhausting, just culturally. It's just a mismatch. Whenever you're the minority, like, it's just tiring. Like, I don't want to go to the pub after work. I don't care about pubs. Like, yeah. Pubs ain't my thing. Like, I'm not a big drinker at all, right? I don't care about cricket. I don't care about rugby. Right, you know what I'm saying? I grew up playing indoor football, like in a cage match, right? I don't have the same cultural touch points as you do. So even though no one's being rude to me or impolite or, you know, even passive aggressive, it's just like I find myself having to put on a bit more performance. And if I'm working from home, I have to put on less of a performance, right? And it's less tiring in that sense. But that's my experience, and I think a lot of people can kind of relate. I'm not surprised about the thing. And I think maybe remote work might be the way to kind of get a more diverse team. Probably it might be a competitive advantage. I know Apple was kind of trying to force everyone back. And I think companies that are going to do that, they're going to lose out. They're going to lose out. And then they're going to look at their diversity stats. They're going to be like, oh, what's going on here? Like, we didn't know. Like, why? Like, have we gone back down, you know, on our numbers and stats, right? So, yeah, I think forward-thinking companies, remote work is the future, like we always say. And it will help you with diversity.
And I think employers should recognize the energy that's taken out of people when they feel the need to conform.
Yeah.
It doesn't really matter what you say. What matters is how individuals behave. And there's only so much control a CEO can have, a CTO can have, a COO can have. Like, you're not observing every single individual's words, actions, habits, behaviors on any given day.
Right.
And the truth is, every single organization still has bad apples, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm the kind of person where it's just like, if there's someone in an environment that is ignorant about stuff and says things that make me feel uncomfortable, I don't want to be around them. And anything I can do to avoid being around them and avoid interacting with them, I will do. And yeah, just to your point, like, I just remember so many points in my career where I just had to, like, fake laugh to managers' bad jokes.
Yeah.
Or, like, you know, feign interest in things that everyone was talking about. All that stuff takes up so much energy. Like, now, in the comfort of my home, I can just get stuff done. I can show up to things I need to show up to. I can be fully present for them, be happy, smile, whatever, and then I can go. And I just think people need to appreciate that underrepresented people put so much energy into fitting a mold, code switching, conforming, that we don't want to do.
Mm-hmm.
But if we don't do that, we face a penalty, like where you judge us or you dismiss us or, you know, at worst, fire us.
Yeah.
So it's like we don't have a choice to opt out of that. Like, that's just what we have been taught gets us through and makes us survive. So, like, just by having the freedom to not be there all the time means that I don't have to fake it as much, and that's nice.
And the only time you have to fake laugh is when you record Techish Now. So it's very much minimized.
I'm just laughing at you.
Yeah, I know, basically.
It's all real. It's all real.
But you know what? So the thing about remote work, though, is the potential for slip-ups. And I think Slack fatigue is one thing, and also just Slack.
Ooh, yeah.
Mishandling of Slack is, I'm going to explain, basically. So there's a story that came out Netflix caught three employees slipping, talking shit on Slack about coworkers. And they thought it was a private channel. They thought it was a private channel. So not only were they being rude, they didn't even realize they basically been incompetent as well. They didn't even know how to use Slack, right? And during meetings, they'd be like, oh, this person's talking this. I mean, we don't know the contents of what they were saying, but I'm guessing it's along the lines of that. Because to be honest, we've all had meetings where we thought that about a person, but you can't do that in a real life meeting because you're there, right? You're in the moment. You can't pass notes like a little school kid. Do you know what I'm saying? So people are taking to Slack to do that, and they're getting caught and they're getting fired. And in this story that was actually quite sad is that the individual who was basically being criticized or chastised or who's been spoken about in a negative manner was Bazoma St. John. Now, if you're in a tech game, if you're in black tech, you know Bazoma St. John. She used to work at Apple. She used to work at Uber. She's now currently CMO at Netflix. She basically is like one of our kind of leading figures in the kind of black tech world. And I don't know what they were saying. I hope it weren't nothing, you know, racist or nothing like that, but I'm guessing it wasn't complimentary at the very least. And yeah, shout out to Netflix. I think they made the right call for firing people. But and also, if you're gonna be an idiot, if you're gonna be rude about people, at least know what you're doing. Understand what's private and what's not. Read your IT policy.
Come on now. But that's just sloppy.
So Netflix came out and said, we do not read people's private messages. But this was not our private channel. They didn't. They were just completely. They bungled it basically, right? What does this story tell you? Like, what do you think about this?
I think what this story tells me is like a number of things. Like, one, there's a real disconnect between like company values and how people actually try to like embody those company values. Like, yeah. Netflix couldn't be what it is if it didn't have like integrity, respect, and, you know, all of those components operating. And it shows that like even the best performers on paper are still going to slide into bad behaviors where they don't live up to your values. And that's actually one of the biggest reasons why companies struggle to meet their diversity goals, because there are people who on face value say that they support initiatives like diversity recruitment, diversity partnerships. But when push comes to shove, their true nature, their true actions, their true words reveal a very different motivation, a very different energy. And I think that is one of the constant challenges of the corporate world. Like, we allow this like duplicity and duality, and it's actually so hard to weed out negative people and bad agents and all that kind of stuff. So that's like the first thing I was going to say, like just like the complexity of human behavior when it comes to workplace. And then the second thing I was going to say is like, people need to pay attention to stuff, because I mean, first of all, you should not say anything on a work channel, email, Slack, DM, I don't even know what, LinkedIn, like literally anything tied to your company. Never say anything on any of those channels that you would not want aired publicly. Full stop.
Full stop.
You want to say something negative? Take that onto some highly encrypted thing. Better yet, audio. Unrecorded audio. You can deny it later. Full-blown denial. Never put in writing what you wouldn't potentially want published on the front cover of a newspaper. And that is just like a best practice for the digital age. Like, it doesn't even matter if you're an individual contributor. It doesn't matter how important you are. Like, just don't say anything in writing that you could later regret, unless it's like in like a deeply private and personal channel. So that is just like a lesson that we all clearly need to be reminded of. Yeah. You would think that people with like big ass salaries at big ass tech companies would know better than to do that. They deserve that. I'm sorry.
I got no pity for them. I got no pity for them whatsoever. Everyone's doing it. You might as well. You might as well. Finish off Abolition's Clubhouse.
Voice notes.
This episode is sponsored by Giving Docs. They are on a mission to build a better world by democratizing estate planning and increasing planned giving. Their software as a service technology platform enables the world's most inspiring nonprofit organizations to dramatically amplify bequests while empowering people to create more impactful legacies. Giving Docs is seeking a full-time lead Python/Flask developer who will be responsible for the development of internal software products and enhancements to our existing products. The link to apply is in the show notes.
So it was reading the news with great rigor on Twitter the other day. But I saw the story about LVMH acquiring a majority stake in Virgil Abloh's Off-White company. And it was really interesting watching all the reactions on Black Twitter to it, because now that LVMH own a majority stake, I think 60% of the business, a lot of people were saying, ain't Black owned no more.
It's not. On the one hand,
I was like, this is incredible, right? Because he's clearly, you know, an amazing innovator, designer, creator, artist. A ton of his collabs, I think, are just sick and awesome. I really wanted one of his like Rimowa suitcases, even though I kind of thought the practicality of having a clear suitcase might not be so good. Anyway, that aside, it is a sign of his success, at him and his team and his company's success, that such a major fashion house would invest in them. But at the same time, does that mean, you know, another great, amazing brand that we as a community have less control over? I'm just curious for your take on this, Mike.
It's difficult. I remember listening to the founder of Carol's Daughter. It's like the hair brand, and then like Jay-Z invested, Oprah invested.
Yes, I used to love that until they got acquired.
Exactly. There we go. Exactly. So she sold the company, and I remember she was saying like, yeah, like she gets so much feedback and hate from people saying like, yo, we should have kept this Black owned. What have you done? You've sold out basically, right? And I think she said, listen, I needed a liquidity event. I've been working on this company for like,
was that on How I Built This?
It may have been.
I think she's like, I've been working on this
product for like 10-12 years, and you know, obviously what a lot of people don't realize is that when you're running the company, you're not necessarily like cash rich. Your net worth might be rich, but you ain't taking out any money yourself to kind of help your family or improve your lifestyle. So I ain't mad at people that sell their companies, but I understand why the community is disappointed. We hold up these entrepreneurs that there are so few that we see successful, and we hold them up to such high esteem. And there is a bit of cynicism. A lot of them are using the whole Black owned, come support me, like I'm Black, I'm one of you, rare. And then when they kind of sell the company, you're like, well, so hold on, what are we doing now? Like, what's going on here? Yeah. And I personally don't mind, so long as they take that capital and maybe now invest in you know, new Black founders, or, you know, at LVMH, if Virgil's there opening doors for new people, where I would be like, this was all a complete, you know, fugazi, is if they're like, he becomes the guy who is like, I'm the only one here. You know, there's a certain type of Black person who wants to get to the high office building and be like, I'm the special one. You guys ain't got nothing on me. I'm the one here. I'm the token Black person. And I'm going to be the one they go to for all advice about Black community and Black culture, right?
That's when it sucks.
So that's when it's like, okay, cool. And if you're taking that money and you're just, you know, moving to a white area and big picket fence and you're not investing in anybody else, that's when I've got a problem with it. So it's a bit of a nuanced take. I understand why people do it. And I have a problem with it if it doesn't follow through and benefit anybody else but themselves, basically, right? And let's keep a reality. Like, if you're running a startup, you eventually do want to exit. And the problem is that majority white-owned corporations got there first. So they have all the capital to acquire you. There isn't, like, a giant Black-owned corporation that can be like, we're going to acquire all these small Black brands. There isn't. This doesn't exist.
LVMH. Turkish Incorporated.
LVMH, I looked it up. It's like, the revenue is like $50 billion a year. Like, who's on that level? Diddy, that's... They would laugh at Diddy. They're laughing at Jay. You know what I'm saying? If they woke up with Jay's money and Diddy's money, they'd cry. You know what I'm saying? Like, so, yeah, I don't know. What's the solution? Do you think we should have to be more understanding and just be like, it is what it is? Or should we just be like...
I think it's about how... I think, first of all, we should be kind to ourselves and, like, recognize the complexity of it. Like, yes, it's important to have Black-owned businesses and generate that wealth and create those job opportunities like you talked about. Also, just, like, culturally, it's important for young people to see that there's so much potential for what Black people can achieve. But on the other hand, it doesn't necessarily take away from the Black community, as you said, when there is an exit into a white-owned company. One, structurally, there's like very limited opportunities for exits of a Black-owned company to another Black-owned company. Ain't nothing we can do about that. And let's be kind to ourselves about that reality. But like you said, it doesn't have to be the end of the value generated. Mm-hmm. If it means that that goes on to more meaningful work, opening doors for other Black people, building the legacy, taking that capital to invest in other things. Like, it can still go on. And, like, for sure, there's, like, some decent enough representation at LVMH because they've been making some moves from, like, you know, Rihanna and, like, you know, there are people doing bits up in there. And, like, this could be an opportunity for more people to get in and do more bits and just keep supporting. So I think it's complex, basically, is my...
Yeah, it is.
What, my conclusion on that.
Does it require somebody to say, I'm not going to take the exit and I'm going to push this company to the biggest scale I can and become the acquirer? I'm going to take on extra capital if needs be and do it. Because one thing I remember is, so there's a website called Amalia.com, which is like a brand for Muslim women. Shout out to Nafisa. She's the CEO. I know her a bit. And she started acquiring like some other like Muslim brands, you know, because she said, listen, not every...
Halal bite.
Yeah.
Halal eat.
Yeah, exactly. Not every day do we have to, you know, dream of being acquired. Sometimes we can be the acquirer, right? Now, obviously on a larger scale, I don't know if that's possible right now, but somebody's going to have to do it and somehow, right? Because at the end of the day, LVMH started... somewhere. It wasn't always the company that it once was. It was a company in the 60s and 70s and whatever back in the day that was a much more smaller scale. And if those companies had all been acquired, that entity wouldn't exist today. So I don't know who's going to do it or how it can be done. I ain't got the brains for that right now, but I feel like it's going to take somebody who's like, I'm not selling. I'm going to scale up as high as I can take this. And then I'll become the acquirer. But
I think that's...
It's tempting, though.
It's a noble cause. It's a noble cause and a risk worth taking. But I think no one exists in a vacuum. No one exists in isolation. You know what I mean? And, like, the minute you as a CEO start to take on outside investment, like, you lose control. Mm. And I think sometimes we're just, like, not fair enough to the power dynamics that leaders have to face and live with every day. And maybe it's like a case of like, I don't know, it's just like one of those things, like once you're in the game, you're in the game. Like to even get to that level, you're gonna have to at some point let people in that aren't aligned fully with that. You know, they want their exit. And then I don't know. I just think that is a noble cause and definitely good, but harder to achieve than it sounds.
But you know what, thinking about it in a startup context, not every company ends up being Facebook. 99% of them don't, right? But because there's so many white founders who get funded, that one in a million happens because a million of them have been funded, right? So Mark Zuckerberg gets to go in there and be like, I've got the $100 billion corporation or the $1 trillion corporation. But because so few of us are funded, we don't have that opportunity, right? There isn't that one in a million of us who's going to make and build that company because there's not enough of us. And it comes down to the pipeline problem, it comes down to the investment problem, it comes down to the same problem. We're not funded enough, basically. And that's the problem. It's funny how everything has the same solution sometimes. It's insane, isn't it?
Money.
Yo, everyone, that is the end of Techish for today. Thank you for listening. Please leave a review. You know, when you leave a review...
Reviews!
It throws us high up the charts. We become superstars. We become celebrities.
Makes us happy.
I get a mansion. Abadesi gets a mansion. It's all great, right, basically. But yeah, no, thanks for listening. Leave a review.
We have egos, too.
All right, cool. Catch you next week.
Bye.
Peace.